Hi, this is Ann Studer with the News Gazette dated October 16th. We'll begin with the front page article from the University of Illinois, Sex Misconduct Policy Ideas Revealed. Provost, campus will implement some of the changes suggested as quickly as possible. The article by Julie Wirth. After months of headlines about employee sexual misconduct at the University of Illinois, a high-level committee is recommending sweeping changes in policies and procedures for handling complaints and improving the campus climate. They include a broader definition of what constitutes sexual harassment, a wider array of sanctions for faculty members, new confidentiality rules, interim steps the U of I can take while an investigation is underway, and other tools designed to make it easier to respond to complaints. The report also recommends expanding staff and resources to help those targeted by sexual harassment and removing barriers that discourage people from reporting it. And it suggests the U of I adopt a pilot project that would require applicants for tenured faculty jobs to waive their confidentiality rights over disciplinary records related to sexual misconduct, as the University of California, Davis has done, to reduce the risk of passing the harasser from one school to the next. At the end of the day, it takes all of us to come to terms with the fact that that's our responsibility, said Provost Andreas Kangalarias. The recommendations are outlined in a 127-page report released Tuesday morning by a committee Kangalarias appointed last January. Chairman Rob Carr and Kangalarias agreed to discuss the report in advance with the News Gazette media. Unanimous support. The recommendations are all supported unanimously by the 14-member committee, said Carr, a law professor who took the lead on the issue for the Academic Senate last fall, following complaints about the sexual harassment investigations of law professor Jay Kaysen and others. The panel includes 8 professors and 6 administrators. The recommendations stem from the guiding principle that the biggest predictor of sexual harassment in an organization is whether there's perceived tolerance of sexual harassment, Carr said. The policy is designed to ensure sexual harassment has no place on this campus, Kangalarias said. The provost said that the campus will act quickly on recommendations that can be implemented right away and consult with the Senate and other groups on those requiring more input. An implementation committee will be appointed to foster that process, he said. We are not waiting anymore, Kangalarias said. There's a lot of eagerness and urgency to get going with changing the culture. The 2 most important changes, and probably the most difficult to reach consensus on, are drafting a new definition of sexual harassment that won't infringe on free speech and developing sanctions for faculty that won't run afoul of concerns about academic freedom, Carr said. Both are designed to allow the U of I to tackle the problem aggressively, but also are consistent with the law, he said. Expanding definition. The new policy would explicitly target broader examples of sexual harassment suggested by national experts, not just instances of quid pro quo harassment or behavior severe or pervasive enough to create a hostile environment, a term borrowed from legal definitions, the report said. In Kaysen's case and several others, investigators found that employees hadn't strictly violated the current policy, even though their behavior was objectionable. The proposed definition would include any unwelcome sexual, sex-based, or gender-based conduct occurring within or having an impact on the workplace or academic environment, regardless of how it is conducted, physically, verbally, in writing, or via an electronic medium, and regardless of the genders of the individuals involved. Allowances would be made for controversial topics in classroom discussions. Expanding repercussions. The new procedures and sanctions would allow the U of I to respond to sexual misconduct more quickly, the committee said, even while adding protections for due process and academic freedom. Currently, U of I statutes mention just 2 sanctions for faculty misconduct: dismissal or severe sanctions short of dismissal, essentially suspension with or without pay for up to 30%. Both require a lengthy hearing process and have rarely been used. The report recommends a formal set of progressive sanctions starting with a letter of expectation or reprimand, then a loss of 1 week's salary, a loss of 1 month's salary, 1 year suspension without pay, and finally, dismissal. Beyond that, misconduct could be considered when deciding on merit raises, awards, sabbaticals, honors, or promotions. The goal is to be able to correct misconduct where possible, the report said, but in severe cases, the university could begin immediate suspension or dismissal proceedings. Expanding education. Other recommendations call for educating faculty about those expectations and ensuring the sanctions are applied in a uniform way across campus. A sanctioning team would advise the provost on those decisions, including the relevant dean and department head, representatives from human resources, legal counsel, and the Office of Access and Equity, and a special senate or faculty representative. Professors would have a right to appeal to a panel with faculty representation. The report recommends changing the statutes to accommodate those progressive sanctions, which would require approval from all three campus senates as well as the Board of Trustees. That has proven difficult in the past. But the committee was structured to bring all viewpoints that needed to be part of this conversation together, Carr said, and my sense is the board is very concerned and wants to play a role. There's a lot of shared will by all parties to move forward. Expanding documentation. The report also recommends beefing up efforts to document problematic behavior. Disciplinary action by department heads would be reported promptly to the Office of Access and Equity so it could be entered into a database. In cases where there is no formal investigation or finding of wrongdoing, but there's credible evidence to support it, a written cautionary notice would be issued for an employee that could be taken into consideration if future allegations arise. The Office of Access and Equity would track the number of cautionary notices by unit and identify departments where group counseling may be needed, the report said. The committee is also urging more transparency about the process through regular reporting of different ways the U of I responds to reports of sexual harassment. The Office of Access and Equity would be required to issue public reports about the general classes of sexual misconduct reports it receives and the sanctions, educational measures, or other remedies taken. New confidentiality rules are designed to encourage more victims to come forward. Information that could identify a complainant would only be shared with people involved in the investigation or response. But any finding of wrongdoing about an employee could be shared more broadly to prevent a recurrence of the misconduct and help monitor for threats of retaliation. Both parties also would get regular updates about the status of an investigation, interim actions, sanctions, and other outcomes. The committee said the U of I should avoid binding non-disclosure agreements, a recommendation that the U of I has already adopted. Other recommendations. The report also said the U of I should ensure the Office of Access and Equity has enough funding and staff to investigate reports quickly. With recent additions, the office now has 4 investigators, a senior investigator, and an associate director. That should allow it to complete investigations within 60 days as opposed to the previous year or more, the report said. Hire more confidential advocates who help victims find resources and decide whether to file complaints. The U of I recently hired 2 for the Women's Resource Center, but more are needed across campus to help students who may be unaware of how to report a problem or reluctant to approach the Title IX office, the report said. The advocates could help assess reports, avoid false alarms, and resolve cases that don't require a full investigation, Kangalaria said. Communicate the proposed changes to the public. Many victims don't report harassment because they don't think what they experienced was severe enough or they think it will be futile, the report said. Form a task force to study voluntary mediation options for resolving complaints informally, as well as restorative processes to address harm, reconcile the two parties, or promote changes in behavior. The Department of Education's changes to Title IX regulations are expected to require universities to make those alternatives available, the report said. Provide sexual misconduct training to campus and faculty review committees. The committee suggested that a separate task force study how the proposed changes would affect processes for students accused of harassment. Students have complained that they were left out of the process, and student government leaders demanded last week that they have input before any recommendations are adopted. Chancellor Robert Jones said he was struck by the depth and breadth of the report. They were able to find consensus on every recommendation. That's huge, Jones said, given the important role faculty play in campus governance. In a related article, task force members discuss report, staff writer Julie Worth asked other members of the Sexual Harassment Committee to weigh in on specific recommendations in the report. Here's what three of them had to say. Jennifer Hardesty, professor and director of undergraduate programs, Department of Health, Human Development and Family Studies, and national expert on intimate partner violence. What do you think was the most important recommendation in the report, and why? From my perspective, no single recommendation is the most important. Instead, collectively, our set of proposed changes address the critical need to change campus climate and culture. We know that the policy changes can only go so far in a climate that tolerates sexual misconduct. One of the recommendations was a new policy governing domestic and dating abuse that would include coercive control without physical violence. Why was that important? Limiting definitions of domestic abuse to acts of violence ignores the vast scientific literature on the dynamics of abusive relationships and the effects of coercive control on victim survivors. We believe including coercive control in our definitions is consistent with the broader changes we hope to make to campus climate and culture, one that is intolerant of abuse and harassment of all forms. Matthew Ando, professor in the Department of Mathematics and associate dean for life and physical sciences in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. You've had to deal with this issue as a department head. Do you think that changes will give supervisors the proper tools to better address cases of sexual harassment during and after investigations? The report makes a family of serious proposals to improve the university's ability to respond to cases of sexual harassment. There is much to be done to implement those proposals. I believe that the recommendations, once implemented, will provide much better tools than we presently have. We must also address culture and climate. I also draw your attention to the report's final recommendation for an ongoing review of the report's implementation. With time and experience, we will learn more about what needs to be done, and we must be prepared to do so. Sexual misconduct has been a serious problem for a very long time. Addressing it is a serious long-term commitment. And Mark Steinberg, professor and associate chairman in the Department of History and 2018-19 chairman of the Senate Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure. Given your background with academic freedom and tenure issues, are you satisfied with the proposals for faculty sanctions and protections for academic freedom and due process? Do you think it will be feasible to change the U of I statutes? I support the recommendations in the report, including recommendations for progressive sanctions. I think the report has been very attentive to academic freedom concerns. I also believe the recommendations for revising the statutes are reasonable and necessary. However, from recent experience with proposed statute changes, I expect this to be very difficult and protracted. From the Champaign School section, CFO's exit deal will cost close to $152,000, by Tim Mitchell. The Champaign School District and its former chief financial officer have agreed to go their separate ways. After exiting a 29-minute closed session Tuesday night, members of the Champaign Unit 4 School Board voted 7-0 to approve a settlement and release agreement with ex-CFO Tom Lockman. Under the terms of the deal, the school district will pay Lockman $151,975, less applicable taxes and withholding, by June 10th of 2020. He will also receive money for any unused vacation time he has or will accrue through November 2019. In turn, Lockman agrees to resign from his job effective December 31st and take an unpaid leave of absence beginning today. He was put on paid leave by the district on June 17th. He also agrees not to file any claims, grievances, charges, or lawsuits in connection with his employment with the Unit 4 School District. Both parties agreed there will be no admissions of fault, responsibility, or liability on either of their parts. The board and administration wish Mr. Lockman well and respectfully declined to comment, said Superintendent Susan Zola following the meeting. Lockman, in a statement emailed to News Gazette Media, said, "I am satisfied with the board's decision to reject Dr. Zola's recommendation to terminate my employment and am very pleased with the resolution. While I am disappointed to be leaving, I am very proud of the work the district has accomplished, grateful for the overwhelming support I have received for my commitment to my work and my principles, and thankful for the opportunity to have served our community in this role. In the near future, we will begin the search for a new chief financial officer," Zola said. "Information regarding the vacancy will be posted on the district's website as it becomes available." In other business, the school board voted 7-0 to approve the latest design for the Edison Middle School project. Construction costs, including for building demolition, site improvements, construction and mechanical, electrical, and plumbing work, are currently estimated at more than $18 million. The overall budget for the project is just more than $25 million. The school board's approval means the building team may now proceed with the construction document phase of design work. Elizabeth Stegmeyer, Unit 4's Director of Capital Projects and Planning, said community members had an opportunity to comment on the project during a September open house. According to the concept approved Tuesday, Edison's Commons areas will be designed to allow students to break into small groups. Its gym will have a high school-sized regulation basketball court and can be divided for three different physical education classes. It will also have a rock climbing wall. Demolition of the school's existing gym and cafeteria space will take place next summer. The third floor will also be renovated then, while work on the second floor will take place during the school year. Sixth graders may be taking classes at the Columbia School Building, currently in use as Dr. Howard Elementary, during construction. Yes, you may be going to Columbia, school board member Chris Kloppel said. Look for an update after Thanksgiving. In the healthcare section, He's Evidence That Men Are At Risk for Breast Cancer, Too, by Deborah Pressey. Some guys would be inclined to ignore a lump on their own breasts, assuming it's nothing. Les Black didn't. After years of doing regular checks for breast lumps with his wife, Cheryl, the 82-year-old Urbana man got in touch with his doctor as soon as he and his wife felt a marble-sized lump in his right breast this past December. Just before Christmas, Les Black was diagnosed with breast cancer. Male breast cancer is a topic men don't generally talk about, he said. He and his wife want to change that. I have been saying, check yourself, he said. You'd be surprised at the men who don't know men get breast cancer. Fewer than 1% of breast cancer cases occur in men, but still more than 2,600 men in the United States were expected to be diagnosed with the disease this year, and about 500 men were expected to die from it. Early detection through mammogram screening and increased awareness of warning signs have reduced breast cancer deaths among women, but men with breast cancer often start out at a disadvantage. They're more likely to be diagnosed at a more advanced cancer stage. And because breast cancer clinical trials are typically designed for women, there are limited Food and Drug Administration approved treatments for men, according to an FDA draft guidance this past August, urging the inclusion of men in breast cancer clinical trials. That's not to say all breast cancer clinical trials exclude men. 8 of the breast cancer clinical trials at Carl are open to both men and women, though men aren't enrolled in any of them, according to Carl spokesman Jamie Mullen. Both men and women share some of the same risk factors for breast cancer, among them older age, a family history of breast cancer, certain gene mutations, radiation exposure, obesity, and being a heavier drinker. Men are also at increased risk if they've had liver disease, certain testicular conditions, and a congenital condition called Klinefelter syndrome. None of those risk factors applied to Black, he said. A retired UPS accounts executive, former umpire for the Champaign-Urbana Park districts, and former part-time security employee at State Farm Center and Memorial Stadium, Black underwent 2 mammograms and then a biopsy that confirmed he had cancer. Less than a month after finding the lump in his breast, he underwent a mastectomy with 8 lymph nodes also removed, the first surgery he'd ever had, he said. He had 5 weeks of radiation therapy, and he's now taking oral tamoxifen, a treatment to reduce the chance of breast cancer recurrence. The Blacks took it all day by day, cherished the support they got from people in their lives, and celebrated small milestones along the way, getting the drains removed from Les's chest after the surgery, his wounds healing, and his finally being able to drive again. The Blacks are convinced early detection saved Les's life. They hope sharing their experience can save more lives. Men, be aware this can happen to you, Cheryl Black said. Women, be aware this could be your husband, your father, or your brother. Having a positive attitude is also important, Les Black said. 10 months after his breast cancer experience began, he hasn't quite recovered the energy he used to have, but he agrees with what his father used to say, that waking up and seeing light means it's a good day. Black said he comes from a line of long-living people, and that includes a 170-year-old aunt who is still working. 107-year-old aunt who is still working. I figure if she can do it, I can do it, he said. In Champaign City Council news, commission's role due for clarification, by Adalberto Toledo. The Champaign City Council on Tuesday unanimously supported a request to clarify the role played by its commissions and subcommittees, spurred in part, according to one council member, by the lack of respect city staff have been shown by some of the groups. The request put forward by Councilmember Clarissa Nickerson-Foreman during a study session followed critical comments by members of the Citizen Review Subcommittee during the public participation portion of Tuesday's meeting. Subcommittee Chairwoman Emily Rodriguez used that time to say she is eager to give the council more information on suggested reforms to the city's police complaint process, while also voicing concerns about recent council comments that her group was overstepping its mandate. Rodriguez said her subcommittee is merely abiding by the 2017 ordinance passed with unanimous consent that established the group. The CRS is part of the legacy of Kiwanis Carrington, Rodriguez said, referring to the 15-year-old victim of what was deemed an accidental police shooting in 2009. The CRS is not only within our mission to issue recommendations, but we would not be fulfilling our mission if we did not do so. I hear from angry residents after every meeting, listening to their frustrations with the complaint process, Rodriguez said. They have visceral feelings that the process is meant to keep them out. Subcommittee member Alexandra Harmon Threat also spoke, saying comments made by council members last week served to undercut a lot of our efforts to improve the process. The citizens of Champaign want and deserve input into the complaint process, she said, asking the council to reaffirm its commitment in having a citizen review of complaints. Foreman said in response that city staff are not being treated with respect by the council's boards and commissions, criticizing specifically the reception Rodriguez's group gave Champaign Police Chief Anthony Cobb in July. We don't expect that from ourselves, so we shouldn't when our staff go in front of a commission, Foreman said. Chief Cobb showed up and talked about what were his concerns. I want to look into these commissions and boards solely because of staff treatment. City staff are having to schedule meetings with board members, but that's not their job. I say if commissioners want to speak to the council, they can. Will Kiles, the sole council member who voiced support last week for looking into the subcommittee's recommendations, said he wants to bring peace to the situation. The reality is that it took a while for this to get even to where we are today, Kiles said, of establishing the Citizen Review Subcommittee. No one wants to sit on a board where they feel it's not going anywhere. People like to believe their work is valued. I think that as council members, the nine of us would be able to say at the study session what's doable and what's not. Mayor Deb Finan said she supported Foreman's request because she does feel the council needs to clarify roles. I think our boards and commissions need to know what is expected of them so their roles are clear to them, Finan said. If they're not meshing, then something's wrong. There have been many times over the course of many years where I have seen recommendations from subcommittees that either pass or fail as they come to the council. That doesn't mean the subcommittee should stop working. It just means we have decisions to make. In other business, council members voted 8-1 to reject citywide zoning changes that represent the latest effort to address concerns from Clark Park residents about the construction trend of big houses in small lots. Most on the council said they opposed the ordinance because of its citywide consequences, saying they don't feel that a few vocal residents of one neighborhood should determine zoning for the rest of the city. Clark Park resident Susan Apple wrote in a letter to the council that she feels it made a slick move in giving the zoning changes a bland description, presumably to quiet public response. This was intentionally chosen so the public can't recognize the subject, she wrote. It has been so renamed as to omit totally any language readily recognizable to explain what it's about. This seems like an underhanded way to cut out public participation. Despite a call by Apple and others to table Tuesday's decision and bring it back later, council members felt the topic needed to take a break. Councilmember Tom Bruno called the Clark Park affair a civil war. I think what we're doing is we're so burned out by the Clark Park civil war that we're willing to make bad law just to put it to rest, Bruno said. Unfortunately, we live in a community of 85,000, and we are about to impose bad law on the 84,000 that don't live in Clark Park because some folks there think their neighbor's house is bigger than they would like it to be. I don't think we'd be doing the city any favors. Also Tuesday, the council voted unanimously to approve setting zoning requirements for any future recreational cannabis dispensary or related business. In more Champaign news, two arrested in bank heist, employee injured, gun recovered by police. And there's a photo of police officers who secured the scene of a reported armed robbery with shots fired Tuesday at Regents Bank in Champaign. Two Champaign teens were arrested a few blocks away shortly after officers arrived and a gun was recovered. Two arrested in bank heist, employee injured, gun recovered by police, by Ben Zigterman. An 18-year-old and a 16-year-old from Champaign were arrested after a reported bank robbery with shots fired this morning in downtown Champaign, police said. Lieutenant Nate Rath said at about 11:30 a.m. Tuesday, officers responded to a report of a robbery at Regents Bank, 111 South State Street in Champaign. Upon arrival, it was determined an armed robbery had occurred with gunfire believed to have been discharged inside the business, Rath said. There were no injuries sustained from the gunfire. However, one employee did receive head injuries after being assaulted by a suspect. Dacher D. Pickens, 18, and a 16-year-old boy were arrested a few blocks away shortly after officers arrived, Rath said, adding that a gun was also recovered. Roads around the bank were blocked during the investigation, and nearby Champaign Central High School and Edison Middle School were placed on a soft lockdown out of an abundance of caution, Rath said. There was no direct threat to the schools, he said. Central Assistant Principal Iris Jones said in an email to parents that students remained inside the schools and in their regular classes for about 10 minutes until the police indicated the soft lockdown could be lifted. Rath said that the investigation is ongoing. If any resident or business in the nearby area has exterior surveillance camera systems, please contact the police department, he said. It is believed video footage may be of investigative assistance. Anyone with information can contact police at 217-351-4545. Tips can also be made anonymously by contacting Crime Stoppers at 217-373-8477, 373tips.com, or via the free P3 Tips mobile app. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half of the October 16th News Gazette. Please stay tuned.